Welcome to the Chemical Sensitivity Podcast. It's a podcast that amplifies the voices of people with multiple chemical sensitivity, or MCS, also known as environmental illness, chemical intolerance, and toxicant-induced loss of tolerance, or TILT. The podcast also highlights emerging research about the illness. This episode is about creating scent-free policies in order to safely accommodate people with MCS. I think it's an important topic and on the minds of many folks with MCS, because we often struggle to be in indoor environments and participate in group activities because of the presence of chemicals and scented products. My guest is Mushim Ikeda. Mushim is a writer and poet and holds a graduate degree in fine arts and poetry writing from the University of Iowa Graduate Writers Workshop. She's been a devoted Buddhist practitioner since the early 1980s. Mushim was born and raised in rural Ohio. Her family was the only Japanese-American family in their community. One of her earliest memories, which we discuss, is of vibrant sunsets caused by pollution from tire factories. Mushim and her adult son both have MCS and live in Oakland, California, where Mushim is a socially engaged Buddhist teacher and mindfulness meditation teacher at the East Bay Meditation Center in downtown Oakland. As the community director at the center, Mushim has played a key role in creating and working with the community to implement a fragrance-free policy to safely accommodate a growing number of people with MCS. It's part of what the center calls its radical inclusivity practices, designed to ensure that all people feel safe and welcome. In our conversation, we speak about how the fragrance-free policy was created, some of the challenges the center encountered, and how it's something that all communities, not just spiritual centers, can strive to adopt. One of the major takeaways from our chat for me was that it's never enough to simply create a fragrance-free policy and post it online or put up a few posters. It requires ongoing education, dialogue, patience, and commitment in order to help make it work for everyone. The work that Mushim and her community have done is really remarkable and could be very helpful for other institutions that are looking for models or information about how to do this. I'll post links to Mushim's website and the East Bay Meditation Center's online information focused on why be fragrance-free, how to be fragrance-free, and lists of scent-free body and house cleaning products. I hope you enjoy the conversation and find it of benefit. We release new episodes twice a month. The best way to never miss one is to subscribe for free wherever you get your podcasts. Leave a review on Apple Podcasts. It's a great way to help others learn about the podcast. Thanks so much for listening. I want to just welcome you to this podcast and thank you very much for joining me today.
You're very welcome. I'm honored to be here. Thank you, Aaron.
There's a lot of different areas that I'm interested in exploring with you. And I wanted first perhaps to invite you to share, what are your experiences with multiple chemical sensitivity?
My sensitivity to scented products began to be more noticeable to me around maybe 13 or 14 years ago, and then began to accelerate rapidly. Before that time, I'm Buddhist. And so I have meditated and been part of so many Buddhist environments where, of course, incense was used as part of the rituals and the creation of a spiritual or sacred environment. And looking back, I am a meditation practitioner and have done many intensive retreats. Ironically, I think it's possible that breathing in all that incense all those years during my monastic and lay training has partially been the cause of my sensitivity, my extreme sensitivity now to incense in any form, including unburned. I see other factors as well, including, again, ironically, Aaron, in my early monastic training in Ann Arbor, Michigan, in the United States. I moved into a Zen Buddhist temple, and we had hardly any money, so we bought an old two-story frame house in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and there was a very robust resident community of cockroaches. Being Buddhist, we tried to coexist peacefully. However, eventually they overran us and we had to exterminate, and I was the temple treasurer. So Everyone else got to go off swimming for the day and had a day away from the temple. And I stayed behind to pay the company that did the extermination. They were very irresponsible, possibly illegal. We paid them so little money because we didn't have much of anything. And they came storming in without calling me, without even shouting. I was on the second floor, and they began immediately fumigating. So I was directly exposed to lethal gas and then ran outside. And there was no outside shower or any way that I could get it off my body. And after that, everyone in the temple actually did become ill that winter with a lot of respiratory illness. And when I think back to it, it's possibly that overdose of chemical that went into my system. However, I have no way of proving it. These are anecdotal incidents. I do know, of course, as do you, and many people do not or are not aware of, that we live in societies in North America in environments where scented and unscented chemicals that may be harmful to the human body are very prevalent.
Absolutely. And it's such a distressing experience that you shared. And I think a lot of people, including myself, we sort of look back into our personal histories and try to identify what it could have been, the triggers, right? In my case, it was also exposure to pesticides. So I really understand. I wanted to ask you also about your early years, your childhood, because I read something that you wrote about your childhood. If I recall correctly, in that passage, you were referring to the color of the sky.
Yes. Thank you for reminding me of that. Aaron, I was born and grew up in the state of Ohio in the Midwest area of the United States, kind of in the central part of the state. I grew up in a semi-rural environment, and the nearest major city was the highly industrialized city of Akron, Ohio, then known as the tire capital of the world. All the major tire factories were there. And those were the days that would have been in the 60s, 1960s, where factory emissions were, I'm sure, completely unchecked. And when the winds were blowing from Akron toward the rural area in which I lived, it smelled exactly like burning tires, because that's what was happening. It was rubber that was being heated and made into tires. And there was so much pollution that went into the air that it produced the most spectacular sunsets that my family had ever seen. On a summer evening, we would go outside, breathe in the smell of burning tires, and exclaim how beautiful the sky was, because it would turn all kinds of colors of pink and orange and rose, and the clouds would look gray. And we were aware at the time that that was pollution that we were breathing in. I do want to take one step back and just add on a note, which may be pertinent, that in Ohio, when I was growing up, my parents both came, they were second generation Japanese Americans, and they both came from agricultural backgrounds. My father, in fact, grew up on a farm in Indiana, and my mother and her siblings grew up in Hawaii, where they worked in the pineapple fields. And again, this was the 1960s. And I think it was DDT. The pesticides were being used so widely because, of course, it yielded a greater farming crop for fruits and vegetables that killed the insects. And I remember my parents reading Rachel Carson's book, Silent Spring, about the dangers of DDT very early on, right after it was published. I remember it sitting on the night table in their bedroom. And I would go in and I would look at the cover, and I would think about that very evocative title, Silent Spring, meaning that the insects were poisoned, therefore the birds that ate the insects would die, and therefore the springtime, instead of being filled with joyful birdsong, would be silent. I'm mentioning this because my parents had an interest in this subject very, very early.
Thank you for sharing that. And I wanted to fast forward in your role at the East Bay Meditation Center. How long have you been involved? And was it your idea to initiate an accommodation policy to make sure it could be a safe place for folks with chemical sensitivity?
East Bay Meditation Center is located in downtown Oakland, one of the most diverse urban areas in the United States. It's been my home for 31 years. And I've been involved with East Bay Meditation Center starting as a board member when we opened our doors in January of 2007. I segued into being a part-time staff member in the year 2012, I believe, and I'm the community director, working a lot with communications, volunteers, and on many of our key committees, including our Radical Inclusivity Committee, which includes in our scope of work looking at issues of access for people and accommodations for people with disabilities, chronic illnesses, chronic pains, and people also who are neurodivergent and have, as we say, differences and limitations of any sort, which should include almost everyone in the broadest view of looking at it. Once again, we opened our doors in 2007. And at that point, I did self-identify as a person with sensitivity to fragranced products, therefore multiple chemical sensitivities, or MCS. And I was one of a small board of 6 members. When we started out, we did everything, including taking our own garbage home because we didn't have a garbage contract. So we were teachers at the center. We were the administrators. We were creating infrastructure using Excel spreadsheets. We basically did everything. And our first rented facility was a small one-room storefront on Broadway in downtown Oakland. We loved that little space. It had 2 wheelchair accessible restrooms and a small office, so it worked well enough for us. And at that point, we did not have air filters and there were no windows that would open. So we couldn't get any ventilation in it at all. And I would say that it was because I was by then very sensitive to fragranced hair and body products, cleaning products, and being part of such a small community to begin with, that the fact that that small board of directors needed and wanted, although there were tensions among us, however, as a body needed and wanted to accommodate me so that we could do in-person meetings, that was a key factor leading to our beginning the work to go towards a fragrance-free meditation center and meeting place, community meeting place. Because as the word got out, then other people with asthma and with MCS, whatever it was called in those days, began to feel, well, this could be a safe space for me, and community momentum developed.
In terms of a Buddhist center, is it quite an anomaly in terms of accessibility for folks with chemical sensitivity?
That's a great question. So fast forwarding from 2007 when we opened our doors, now it's 2022. For many years, not only our fragrance, what became a fragrance-free policy, many other forms of access that we were trying to provide did make us fairly unique. And as a teacher, I used to say, East Bay Meditation Center is unique and we don't want to be. We do not want to be an anomaly. We don't want to be unique. We want to set the bar for a spiritual environment that is as welcoming and healthy for as many people as possible. And I'm happy to say that in the intervening years, we have now become less unique and less of an anomaly. That section of the website on fragrance-free products, the reason why we wish to be fragrance-free, lots of information, lots of product listings for household cleaning products, hair, body products, including products that are especially good for people of color, has been used by so many groups, not just Buddhist, any kinds of groups. Therefore, in answer to your question or to sum up, we would like to see this information about being fragrance-free and why spread even more widely, and we're not forcing it on anyone. However, it is spreading more widely in many different circles.
As far as I know, you've really been a leader in this work to create radical inclusivity policy, including for folks with chemical sensitivity. And it's good to hear that it's catching on. Is there something unique about Buddhism that mandates you to care for others, to create a respectful space? Or is this just something that anyone who's creating a space for the public can learn from?
I would say both and. This is a public health issue in how we look at it. And from years ago, the information that I saw online in the United States is that this was from, I believe, HUD, the Housing and Urban Development Department of the United States government. And there was, I think, a YouTube video that showed an official saying that for government-funded housing projects, that people with multiple chemical sensitivities are categorized as people with disabilities and therefore need to, by law, have access to housing which is safe for people with this disability. So in our point of view, it's good for everyone to consider it as a public health issue. In Buddhism, there's a lot of emphasis on compassion. And of course, that is not some unique Buddhist philosophy or term or concept. Insofar as I know, and I do quite a bit of interfaith work and dialogue, compassion is essential to human beings. It is present in all spiritual and religious traditions and in the atheist world as well, because it doesn't have to do with any particular, as far as I know, religious commandments, or, I mean, they might be connected. However, universally, to human beings, unless we're able to develop the quality of compassion, which as a word in English literally means suffering with others, come with passion, suffering, that we empathize. We've got these apparently mirror neurons in our brains that when we see like a dog with an injured leg or a person who is in pain, a child who's crying because they're so tired or because they're hungry, there's something in our heart minds, as Buddhists would say, there's something in us that resonates with it and which arouses the desire to say, how can I help? How can I be of service? How can we have a more compassionate society? Now, Buddhism does have a set of beliefs and teachings as to why universal compassion isn't in fact realized globally throughout human societies. And in our system of beliefs, everything goes back. We don't have a concept of sin, I would say. Neither do we have a creator God. It goes back to also that within human beings, there is compassion, there is love, there is empathy, and there is also what we call greed, hatred, and delusion, the qualities that lead to separation, discrimination, and wars.
Has it been easy to invite everyone or to bring folks on board?
It has not been easy. What I can say is that I think we're now in our 16th year of operations, and East Bay Meditation Center was incorporated as a nonprofit in the United States for maybe 9 years even before then. However, we didn't have a physical place to call our own until January of 2007. And I would say it's been a continual struggle since 2008, I would say, is when we were open to the public for more events and more meditation groups and classes. It has been a continual struggle. It has been extremely divisive. There have been many tensions and conflicts that have arisen, many painful disagreements, ruptures of relationships. It has been, I would say, the single most divisive issue in our spiritual community, which was intentionally created to try to form a meditation, mindfulness meditation based, usually mindfulness meditation based, Buddhist-based spiritual community in the Bay Area in the United States, which is an area which is extremely diverse in terms of race, ethnicity, sexual orientation, gender identity, immigration status, and many other diversity dimensions as well. That's part of our mission. That's part of our vision. We used to say we were founded in a celebration of diversity. So it's not that we're coming together in spite of our differences. We're coming together because of our differences. It's an experiment. How can we get along? How can we be on the ground, not with just with theory, but with the realities, which are often very difficult, as you know, because everyone has different, or many people have different views, have different lived experiences, have different conditioning that have validly led them to their points of view today. Most people feel I'm right and have good reason to do so because their life experience has been the foundation. We came together as a group to say, we have different life experiences. How can we learn from one another instead of fracturing along lines of difference? How can we come together in order to experimentally form, we might say, a microcosm of a society that is more liberated, that is more accessible, and that has ways to hold difficult conversations? Because in the United States, I'll just speak for the United States. I'm a United Statesian, was born and raised in the United States. Our society is one of a lot of emphasis on the rights of the individual to choose what the individual feels will help an individual feel happier, feel more attractive, will feel more comfortable. And because diversity is a fact of life, then we end up in public situations or places where people gather with many individuals who feel, because we live in a consumer society as well, that it is their right and something that they've worked really hard for. They, you know, most people work so hard to earn their money. We serve, we were founded as a meditation center to serve low-income people and people from historically excluded communities, such as Black, Indigenous, people of color communities, the LGBTQI, two-spirit communities, and people with disabilities, as well as low-income people from low-income communities. And many of the people who come to East Bay Meditation Center very understandably feel, I have struggled so hard for my family and for myself, and so to give myself some joy in life, I like to be able to choose the laundry products to make my clothes smell like spring, and to scent my car and my home, and to burn scented candles, and to have body products that help me feel more attractive, that help me feel more confident. And also, this is very important, Erin, as you undoubtedly know, many people feel that, very understandably, that I want to choose the products that go on my hair and skin and fragrances that I might use, such as cologne or perfume or botanical oils that relate to my ancestral identification and that connect me to my root spiritual traditions. So if our ancestors come from some part of Africa, if our ancestors are indigenous people from any part of the world for whom, for instance, burning sage and other fragranced natural things is part of very deeply significant spiritual traditions that help connect us to the earth and to one another, this is not something that you can tell people, well, it's really better for the community health, just don't do it, because when you come to the center, even if you put on clothing that's been laundered in fragrance-free products, if it's in your house in the closet and hasn't been exposed, or if you have one of those, ironically, deodorant hanging tabs in your car, your clothes, your hair, everything is going to pick up all of that chemical, which is off-gassing, because that's how what it's meant to do. It's meant to scent everything. And then when you arrive at the meditation center, you might say, I used fragrance-free shampoo. I put on fragrance-free clothing. How can you say that I'm endangering anyone's health? I'm a good person. I'm not harmful. You can see how many hurt feelings and how much information is needed. Not only information is needed, but what we found out is that I would say for a person who uses a lot of scented products, which is most people in the United States, becoming 100% fragrance-free is a process, if the person even wants to do it, that takes a minimum of 1 year, possibly 2 years. Because here would be a typical example. We had one wonderful volunteer who gave probably hundreds of hours to our Everybody, Every Mind Sangha, which is a meditation-based group that is still meeting now online every Sunday evening for people with chronic illnesses, chronic pain, disabilities, differences and limitations of any sort. And this wonderful volunteer was happy to become fragrance-free. However, their spouse insisted on using fragranced laundry products because the spouse felt, this is what makes me happy and makes our clothes feel clean and good to me. Therefore, this volunteer had to figure out a way to have a full set of fragrance-free clothes in a closet, in a special bag or some kind of container that could not be permeated with the laundry products that were on all the other clothes in the closet, and figure out a way to get on those clothes, take a shower, use all fragrance-free materials, and then come to the center and hope that they didn't pick up some scents as even as they walked through their own house. This was a person who wanted to do it and who themselves identified as a person with a disability, so their compassion was huge. And we don't live alone. We're with other people who make other choices. It's a process that is not up to individual choice. An individual may say, I want to be fragrance-free. It doesn't work like that. To some extent, their families, people in their apartment buildings, in the laundry rooms, the entire society in outward ripples needs to begin to consider what it means to be fragrance-free. And that means that the large corporations that are selling all of these scented products and making millions and billions of dollars will lose revenue if the encouragement to using just very simple fragrance-free products becomes more widespread in our society. It's an economic and political issue as well as a health issue.
It's really incredible to hear you speak in detail about the great lengths that you and your community have gone to create a safe space for people with chemical sensitivity. Do you have any words of encouragement in light of the challenges that you've outlined, Mashim?
I do. Thank you for asking. My first word of encouragement is to look toward medical professional institutions and what they're recommending and how they're doing it to try to provide and encourage more fragrance-free and scent-free environments for public health. So for instance, years and years ago in Oakland, Kaiser Permanente is one of the very largest health providing organizations. I'm a member, that's my medical insurance, and I went to get physical therapy, and right in the waiting room, I was so happy to see there was a sign, a very nice sign on a floor stand that said something like, please do not wear perfume or cologne or scented products. And that has spread throughout, again, the medical providing systems. I've noticed that dentist's office as well. So in other words, medical and dental and health professionals who come very close to and will touch people's bodies, they're all scent-free now. So to look towards that and say, if they're doing it and their specialty is health, that's something that we can learn from. And also look at their signage, look at how they're doing that. They must obviously be requiring their employees to be fragrance-free. That's number one. Number two, the takeaway is this is not something where we can make a sign, even set a policy, and say, oh, goody, now we're on to the next issue. It has to be a commitment to ongoing education and, very importantly, ongoing community conversations, where if tensions and conflicts arise, people aren't just shut down, which means they'll be angry and they'll either leave and go elsewhere, or they'll start to dig in and then a mini war erupts. So it's an ongoing, very deep commitment to how are we able to open what some communities called difficult conversations? And how do we provide facilitated community forums in any form? It could be online, it could be in-person town halls, it could be little mini breakout sessions within various groups, so that everyone can be heard and hear one another with facilitation that tries to guarantee as much as possible that the civic discourse is respectful, inclusive, and is a practice of deep listening. In deep listening, we agree to put aside our own views for the moment and not to be rehearsing in our heads things that we want to say instead of listening to actually what other people are saying. And this is, again, an ongoing process. It's not something that we're ever done with. However, it does mean that whole communities can gain the skills that are needed to be able to hold conversations across lines of difference that are respectful and in which a great deal of compassionate learning takes place, and we're able to move in the direction of communities that embody loving kindness and caring for all members of our communities. And people will change. They will say, yes, I love my favorite cologne. I love my favorite perfume. And I also love my community. So I can see I'm going to have to make some changes. And it's taking me a while. And I'm willing to make those changes. And you see the difference between that kind of attitude as opposed to, well, the group I want to go to has this rule and this law, and they don't listen to me. They don't care anything about me. So I guess it's just stay or go, their way or the highway. It's a totally different kind of atmosphere when the community feels that their voices count and that they have helped to dialogue with one another. So looking to the medical professions and dental professions, number one. Number two takeaway, the commitment to ongoing learning about how to have conversations across lines of difference and disagreement. And number three, becoming creative in all of the many ways that what we call education might take place, because different people learn things in different ways over time. And one thing that we've done, in addition to experimenting with signage, with the section on our website, so that's written communication, is also how people can give what we call the fragrance-free talk at in-person events, training our volunteers, training our teachers, training our staff, and how to give a talk that is friendly, that is compassionate, that is informative, that is brief. And we've also have a small by donation fragrance-free shop errand, where we have little travel size bottles and containers of fragrance-free personal products that people are invited to take on a donation basis, meaning if they don't have any money to give, they can take whatever they like and they don't have to leave any money at all. There's a little basket, and then people who can afford to give would put in their coins and their bills, and also to receive input from the community as to the specific products that are offered, so that we try, for instance, to offer sample products for people with many different types of hair, and so a hair product that really works for them and that makes them feel happy with their appearance, as well as personal products such as a skin lotion, and then, of course, there's laundry detergent as well.
You spoke about empathy and compassion, and a lot of the times we find ourselves either working or going to or having to be in spaces or organizations where those values may not be priorities. They may have other priorities, right? And so In my experience, that may make it a little bit more difficult to invite people to come on board with scent-free policies.
I wear a number of hats, and one of those is I am an independent diversity, equity, inclusion, and access consultant, mostly for Buddhist groups, for some educational institutions as well. And there is what we might call a business case to be made for fragrance-free environments. In my point of view, it does have to do with the public health. A healthier work environment is going to be one in which you have fewer workers who are getting sick and who are able, in just raw capitalistic terms, they'll be more productive than someone who's experiencing brain fog. Maybe they don't say, I'm sick and I have to go home. Maybe they're at their workstation and they're not working efficiently or effectively because they're battling these chemicals that they're breathing in or that are on their skin. It doesn't have to be about empathy and compassion. It could be about raising your profit margin. We can make that case as well. In terms of empathy and compassion, I'm a parent and I've worked with a lot of children. I was a volunteer in the Oakland Public Schools for 11 years. And I love working with children and teenagers and youth, maybe even a little bit more than with adults. However, I love working with adults also. Empathy and compassion are abilities or traits that the human being as a mammal is born with. My understanding is that we share the same brain structure. All mammals share the basic same brain structure. And as we know, dogs and horses and many other mammals have been demonstrated to show empathy and compassion and caring. So it undoubtedly has an evolutionary function as well for the survival of the species and the well-being of one's tribe or clan or whatever group that the animal is in. So when we look at empathy and compassion, the seeds of those qualities are in us at birth, and they need to be developed, or they can be shut down or almost erased. There may be a few individuals who are what we call sociopathic. However, they're greatly in the minority in society. And for most of us, we're looking at how we can, again, open conversations, how we can provide information. Just look at the basic question of what is it that creates more, number one, curiosity about what you pointed to as invisible disabilities. If we see someone in a wheelchair, we can make all kinds of assumptions. We don't really know why they're in the wheelchair at all. They may even be able to walk, just be in such chronic pain that they're using the wheelchair, or maybe they're physically unable to walk. However, we do know they're using that wheelchair, and we might be able to see that their lives probably aren't easy in terms of access, and therefore compassion and empathy can arise. For people with invisible disabilities, there aren't the exterior signs or cues, and therefore it needs to be a process of dialogue. It needs to be a process that could take quite a while. Ironically, that can be shut down, because if, as a person with MCS, this has happened to me many times. I don't know if it's happened to you. People whom I genuinely care about, whom I'm trying to say, you are wearing scented products. You have scented products that are making me very, very ill, become so anxious because they love me so much that they want to come really close to me and say, Mushim, I would never do anything to hurt you. I love you. I love you. And they're actually in my face or grabbing onto me, making me sicker and sicker as every second goes past. So this is something that we need to work with over time. We need to develop more understanding. It won't be fast, and it will be accomplished only through hundreds and thousands and millions of conversations among individuals, small groups, larger groups, and at the societal level and in public health policy, in order for people to feel that sense of, more people to feel that sense of empathy and compassion of, I don't have those sensitivities to fragranced or scented household cleaning products, industrial cleaning products, to people's personal products. And someone in my family could. Maybe I don't have children now. Maybe I'll have children in 5 years and one of my children will have asthma. I want to work to create that society now, that environment now, so that my future child can be healthy.
So as you move forward as an organization, informing folks about fragrance-free will continue to be a priority?
It will, I'm happy to say. And one thing I didn't mention is that East Bay Meditation Center uses all fragrance-free cleaning products in our bathrooms, in any of our spaces, and that this provides a model for people who do like fragranced environments to be in a public gathering place and to go and use the bathrooms and to see how they feel about being in a fragrance-free environment. And many of them get used to it and love it.
Well, Mashim, I want to thank you so much for everything you've shared and for all the work that you and your colleagues and community are doing. It's so important. I'll invite listeners to check out all the work you're doing online. And again, thank you so much for your leadership and for taking time to speak with me today.
Thank you so very much for your work as well. And thank you to everyone who is listening and watching, who is interested, who's curious in learning more, or who may already be part of an organization that is working to provide fragrance-free environments.
That brings us to the end of this episode of the Chemical Sensitivity Podcast. Thank you very much to Mashim Ikeda for taking time to speak with me. The podcast is produced by me, Aaron Goodman, and Danny Penaloza. We release new episodes twice a month. Please subscribe for free wherever you get your podcasts. Leave a review on Apple Podcasts. It's a great way to help others find the podcast. And follow us on social media. Just search for the Chemical Sensitivity Podcast or Podcasting MCS. If there's someone you'd like to hear interviewed on the podcast or a topic you'd like us to explore, just let me know. Email me at info@chemicalsensitivitypodcast.org. And thanks so much for listening.